Side 4. Chapter 8. But first, we had to get there. It was 8 miles from Klingman's Dome to U.S. 441, the first paved road since Fontana Dam 4 days before. Gatlinburg lay 15 long, twisting downhill miles to the north. It was too far to walk, and it didn't seem likely that we would get a lift hitching in a national park, but in a parking area nearby, I noticed 3 homeward-bound youths loading packs into a large, fancy car with New Hampshire number plates. And impulsively, I went and introduced myself to them as a fellow citizen of the Granite State and asked them if they could find it in their hearts to take 2 weary old guys into Gatlinburg. Before they could demur, which was clearly their instinct, we thanked them profusely and climbed into the back seat. And thus we secured a stylish but rather sullen passage to Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg is a shock to the system from whichever angle you survey it, but never more so than when you descend upon it from a spell of moist, grubby isolation in the woods. It sits just outside the main entrance to Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and specializes in providing all those things that the park does not, principally slurpy food, motels, gift shops, and sidewalks on which to waddle and dawdle, nearly all of it strewn along a single, astoundingly ugly main street. For years, it has prospered on the confident understanding that when Americans load up their cars and drive enormous distances to a setting of rare natural splendor, what most of them want when they get there is to play a little crazy golf and eat dribbly food. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is the most popular national park in America, but Gatlinburg, this is so unbelievable, is more popular than the park. So Gatlinburg is appalling, but that's okay. After 8 days on the trail, we were ready to be appalled, eager to be appalled. We checked into a motel where we were received with a palpable lack of warmth, got honked at twice as we crossed the main street, one rather loses the knack of crossing roads on the trail, and finally presented ourselves at an establishment called Jersey Joe's Restaurant, where we ordered cheeseburgers and Cokes from a charmless, gum-popping waitress who declined to be heartened by our wholesome smiles. We were halfway through this simple, disappointing repast when the waitress dropped the bill on the table as she passed. It came to $20.74. "You're joking," I spluttered. The waitress, let's call her Betty Slutz, stopped and looked at me, then slowly swaggered back to the table, staring at me with majestic disdain the while.
"You got a problem here?"
$20 is a bit much for a couple of burgers, don't you think?" I squeaked in a strange, never-before-heard Bertie Wooster voice. She held her stare for another moment, then picked up the bill and read it through aloud for our benefit, smacking each item as she read.
2 burgers, 2 sodas, state sales tax, city sales tax, beverage tax, inclusive gratuity. Grand total, $20.74.
She let it fall back onto the table and graced us with a sneer.
Welcome to Gatlinburg, gentlemen.
Welcome indeed. And then we went out to see the town. I was particularly eager to have a look at Gatlinburg because I had read about it in a wonderful book called The Lost Continent. In it, the author describes the scene on the main street thus. Walking in an unhurried fashion up and down the street were more crowds of overweight tourists in boisterous clothes, with cameras bouncing on their bellies, consuming ice creams, cotton candy, and corn dogs, sometimes simultaneously. And so it was today. The same throngs of pear-shaped people in Reeboks wandered between food smells, clutching grotesque comestibles and bucket-sized soft drinks. It was still the same tacky, horrible place. Yet I would hardly have recognized it from just 9 years before. Nearly every building I remembered had been torn down and replaced with something new, principally mini-malls and shopping courts, which stretched back from the main street and offered a whole new galaxy of shopping and eating opportunities. In The Lost Continent, I gave a specimen list of Gatlinburg's attractions as they were in 1987. The Elvis Presley Hall of Fame, National Bible Museum, Stars Over Gatlinburg Wax Museum, Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum, American Historical Wax Museum, Gatlinburg Space Needle, Bonnie Lou and Buster Country Music Show, Carbo's Police Museum, Guinness Book of Records Exhibition Center, Earlene Mandrell Hall of Stars Museum and Shopping Mall, a pair of haunted houses, and three miscellaneous attractions, Hillbilly Village, Paradise Island, and World of Illusions. Of these 15 diversions, just three appeared to be still in existence 9 years later. They had, of course, been replaced by other things. A mysterious mansion, hillbilly golf, a Motion Master ride. And these, in turn, will no doubt be gone in another 9 years, for that is the way of America. I know the world is ever in motion, but the speed of change in the United States is simply dazzling. In 1951, the year I was born, Gatlinburg had just one retail business, a general store called Ogle's. Then, as the post-war boom years quickened, people began coming to the Smokies by car, and motels, restaurants, gas stations, and gift shops popped up to serve them. By 1987, Gatlinburg had 60 motels and 200 gift shops. Today, it has 100 motels and 400 gift shops. And the remarkable thing is that there is nothing remotely remarkable about that. Consider this. Half of all the offices and malls standing in America today have been built since 1980. Half of them. 80% of all the housing stock in the country dates from 1945. Of all the motel rooms in America, 230,000 have been built in the last 15 years. Just up the road from Gatlinburg is the town of Pigeon Forge, which 20 years ago was a sleepy hamlet, nay, which aspired to be a sleepy hamlet, famous only as the hometown of Dolly Parton. Then the estimable Ms. Parton built an amusement park called Dollywood. Now Pigeon Forge has 200 outlet shops stretched along 3 miles of highway. It is bigger and uglier than Gatlinburg and has better parking. And so, of course, it gets more visitors. Now compare all this with the Appalachian Trail. At the time of our hike, the Appalachian Trail was 59 years old. That is, by American standards, incredibly venerable. The Oregon and Santa Fe trails didn't last as long. Route 66 didn't last as long. The old coast-to-coast Lincoln Highway, a road that brought transforming wealth and life to hundreds of little towns, so important and familiar that it became known as America's Main Street, didn't last as long. Nothing in America does. If a product or enterprise doesn't constantly reinvent itself, it is superseded, cast aside, abandoned without sentiment in favor of something bigger, newer, and alas, always, always uglier. And then there is the good old AT, still quietly ticking along after 6 decades, unassuming, splendid, faithful to its founding principles, sweetly unaware that the world has quite moved on. It's a miracle, really. Katz needed bootlaces, so we went to an outfitter's, and while he was off in the footwear section, I had an idle shuffle around. Pinned to a wall was a map showing the whole of the Appalachian Trail on its long march through 14 states, but with the eastern seaboard rotated to give the AT the appearance of having a due north-south orientation, allowing the mapmaker to fit the trail into an orderly rectangle about 6 inches wide and 4 feet high. I looked at it with a polite, almost proprietorial interest. It was the first time since leaving New Hampshire that I had considered the trail in its entirety, and then inclined closer with bigger eyes and slightly parted lips. Of the 4 feet of trail map before me, reaching approximately from my knees to the top of my head, we had done the bottom 2 inches. I went and got Katz and brought him back with me, pulling on a pinch of shirt sleeve. "What?" he said. "What?" I showed him the map. "Yeah, what?" Katz didn't like mysteries. "Look at the map, and then look at the part we've walked." He looked, then looked again. I watched closely as the expression drained from his face. "Jesus," he breathed at last. He turned to me, full of astonishment. "We've done nothing." We went and got a cup of coffee and sat for some time in a kind of dumbfounded silence. All that we had experienced and done, all the effort and toil, the aches, the damp, the mountains, the horrible stodgy noodles, the blizzards, the dreary evenings with Mary Ellen, the endless, wearying, doggedly accumulated miles, all that came to 2 inches. My hair had grown more than that. One thing was obvious. We were never going to walk to Maine. In a way, it was a liberation. If we couldn't walk the whole trail, we also didn't have to, which was a novel thought that grew more attractive the more we considered it. We had been released from our obligations. A whole dimension of drudgery, the tedious, mad, really quite pointless business of stepping over every inch of rocky ground between Georgia and Maine, had been removed. We could enjoy ourselves. So the next morning after breakfast, we spread maps out across my motel room bed and studied the possibilities. In the end, we decided to return to the trail not at Newfound Gap, where we had left it, but a little further on at a place called Spivey Gap near Ernestville. This would take us beyond the Smokies, with its crowded shelters and stifling regulations, and put us back in a world where we could please ourselves. I got out the yellow pages and looked up cab companies. There were 3 in Gatlinburg. I called the first one. "How much would it be to take 2 of us to Ernestville?" I inquired.
"Dunno," came the reply.
This threw me slightly. "Well, how much do you think it would be?"
"Dunno."
"But it's just down the road." There was a considerable silence, and then the voice said, "Yep." "Haven't you ever taken anybody there before?"
"Nope."
"Well, it looks to me on my map like it's about 20 miles. Would you say that's about right?" Another pause.
"Might be."
"And how much would it be to take us 20 miles?"
"Dunno."
I looked at the receiver. "Excuse me, but I just have to say this. You are more stupid than a paramecium." Then I hung up.
"Maybe not my place to say," Katz offered thoughtfully, "but I'm not sure that's the best way to ensure prompt and cheerful service."
I called up another cab company and asked how much it would be to Ernestville.
"Dunno,"
said the voice. "Oh, for Christ's sake," I thought.
"What do you want to go there for?" demanded the voice.
"Pardon?
What do you want to go to Ernestville for? Tain't nothing there."
"Well, actually, we want to go to Spivey Gap. We're hiking the Appalachian Trail, you see."
"Spivey Gap's another 5 miles."
"Yeah, I was just trying to get an idea."
"You should have said so, because Spivey Gap's another 5 miles.
"Well, how much would it be to Spivey Gap, then?"
"Dunno."
"Excuse me, but is there some kind of gross stupidity requirement to be a cab driver in Gatlinburg?"
"What?"
I hung up again and looked at Katz.
"What is it with this town? I've blown more intelligent life into a handkerchief."
I called up the third and final company and asked how much it would be to Ernestville.
"How much you got?" barked a feisty voice.
Now, here was a guy I could do business with. I grinned and said, "I don't know, $1.50? There was a snort.
"Well, it's going to cost you more than that."
A pause and the creak of a chair going back.
"It's going to go on what's on the meter, you understand? But I expect it'll be about $20, something like that. What do you want to go to Ernestville for, anyway?"
I explained about Spivey Gap and the AT.
"Appalachian Trail? You must be a dang fool. What time you want to go?"
I don't know. How about now?"
"Where you at?"
I told him the name of the motel.
"I'll be there in 10 minutes. 15 minutes at the outside. If I'm not there in 20 minutes, then go on ahead without me, and I'll meet you at Ernestville."
He hung up. We had not only found a driver, we'd found a comedian. While we waited on a bench outside the motel office, I bought a copy of the Nashville, Tennessean newspaper out of a metal box, just to see what was happening in the world. The principal story indicated that the state legislature, in one of those moments of enlightenment with which the southern states often distinguish themselves, was in the process of passing a law banning schools from teaching evolution. Instead, they were to be required to instruct that the earth was created by God in 7 days, sometime before the turn of the century. The article reminded us that this was not a new issue in Tennessee. The little town of Dayton, not far from where Katz and I now sat, as it happened, was the scene of the famous Scopes trial in 1925, when the state prosecuted a schoolteacher named John Thomas Scopes for rashly promulgating Darwinian hogwash. As nearly everyone knows, Clarence Darrow for the defense roundly humiliated William Jennings Bryan for the prosecution. But what most people don't realize is that Darrow lost the case. Scopes was convicted, and the law wasn't overturned in Tennessee until 1967. And now the state was about to bring the law back, proving conclusively that the danger for Tennesseans isn't so much that they may be descended from apes as that they may be overtaken by them. Suddenly, I can't altogether explain it, but suddenly, I had a powerful urge not to be this far south any longer. I turned to Katz. Why don't we go to Virginia?
What?
Somebody in his shelter a couple of days before had told us how delightful, how gorgeously amenable to hiking the mountains of the Virginia Blue Ridge were. Once you got up into them, he had assured us, it was nearly all level walking, with sumptuous views over the broad valley of the Shenandoah River. People routinely knocked off 25 miles a day up there. From the vantage of a dank, dripping, smoky shelter, this had sounded like Xanadu, and the idea had stuck. I explained my thinking to Katz. He sat forward intently.
Are you saying we leave out all the trail between here and Virginia? Not walk it? Skip it?
He seemed to want to make sure he understood this exactly. I nodded.
Well, shit, yes!
So when the cab driver pulled up a minute later and got out to look us over, I explained to him, hesitantly and a bit haplessly, for I had not really thought this through, that we didn't want to go to Ernestville at all now, but to Virginia.
Virginia,
he said, as if I'd asked him if there was anywhere local we could get a dose of syphilis. He was a little guy, short, but built like iron and at least 70 years old, but real bright, smarter than me and Katz put together. And he grasped the notion of the enterprise before I had halfway explained it.
Well, then you want to go to Knoxville and rent a car and drive up to Roanoke. That's what you want to do.
I nodded. How do we get to Knoxville?
How's a cab sound to you? He barked at me, as if I were three-quarters stupid.
I think he might have been a bit hard of hearing, or else he just liked shouting at people.
Probably cost you about $50, he said speculatively.
Katz and I looked at each other.
Yeah, okay, I said.
Then we got in.
And so, just like that, we found ourselves heading for Roanoke and the sweet green hills of old Virginia.
Chapter 9. In the summer of 1948, Earl V. Schaffer, a young man just out of the army, became the first person to hike the Appalachian Trail from end to end in a single summer. With no tent, and often navigating with nothing better than road maps, he walked for 123 days, from April to August, averaging 17 miles a day. Coincidentally, while he was hiking, the Appalachian Trailway News, the journal of the Appalachian Trail Conference, ran a long article by Myron Avery and the magazine's editor, Gene Stephenson, explaining why an end-to-end hike was probably not possible. The trail Schaffer found was nothing like the groomed and orderly corridor that exists today. Though it was only 11 years since the trail's completion, by 1948 it was already subsiding into oblivion. Schaffer found that large parts of it were overgrown or erased by wholesale logging. Shelters were few, blazes often non-existent. He spent long periods bushwhacking over tangled mountains or following the wrong path when the trail forked. Occasionally, he stepped onto a highway to find that he was miles from where he ought to be. Often, he discovered that local people were not aware of the trail's existence, or, if they knew of it, were amazed to be told that it ran all the way from Georgia to Maine. Frequently, he was greeted with suspicion. On the other hand, even the dustiest little hamlets nearly always had a store or cafe, unlike now. And generally, when he left the trail, he could count on a country bus to flag down for a lift to the nearest town. Although he saw almost no other hikers in the 4 months, there was other real life along the trail. He often passed small farms and cabins, or found graziers tending herds on sunny balds. All those are long gone now. Today, the AT is a wilderness by design. Actually, by fiat,
since many of the properties Schaffer passed were later compulsorily purchased and quietly returned to woodland. There were twice as many songbirds in the eastern United States in 1948 as now. Except for the chestnuts, the forest trees were healthy. Dogwood, elms, hemlocks, balsam firs, and red spruces still thrived. Above all, he had 2,000 miles of trail almost entirely to himself. When Schaffer completed the walk in early August, 4 months to the day after setting off, and reported his achievement to conference headquarters, no one there actually believed him. He had to show officials his photographs and trail journal, and undergo a charming but thorough cross-examination, as he put it in his later account of the journey, walking with Spring, before his story was finally accepted. When news of Schaffer's hike leaked out, it attracted a good deal of attention. Newspapers came to interview him. The National Geographic ran a long article. And the AT underwent a modest revival. But hiking has always been a marginal pursuit in America. And within a few years, the AT was once more largely forgotten, except among a few diehards and eccentrics. In the early 1960s, a plan was put forward to extend the Blue Ridge Parkway, a scenic highway, south from the Smokies, by building over the southern portion of the AT. That plan failed on grounds of cost, not because of any particular outcry. But elsewhere, the trail was nibbled away or reduced to a rutted, muddy track through zones of commerce. In 1958, as we've seen, 20 miles were lopped off the southern end from Mount Oglethorpe to Springer Mountain. By the mid-1960s, it looked to any prudent observer as if the AT would survive only as scattered fragments. In the Smokies and Shenandoah National Park, from Vermont across to Maine, as forlorn relic strands in the odd state park, but otherwise buried under shopping malls and housing developments. Much of the trail crossed private land, and new owners often revoked informal rights-of-way agreements, forcing confused and hasty relocations onto busy highways or other public roads, hardly the tranquil wilderness experience envisaged by Benton Mackay. Once again, the AT looked doomed. Then, in a timely piece of fortuitousness, America got a Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall, who actually liked hiking. Under his direction, a National Trails System Act was passed in 1968. The law was ambitious and far-reaching, and largely never realized. It envisioned 25,000 miles of new hiking trails across America, most of which were never built. However, it did produce the Pacific Crest Trail and secured the future of the AT by making it a de facto national park. It also provided funds, $170 million since 1978, for the purchase of private land to provide a wilderness buffer alongside it. Now nearly all the trail passes through protected wilderness. Just 21 miles of it, less than 1% of the total, is on public roads, mostly on bridges and where it passes through towns. In the half-century since Schaffer's hike, about 4,000 others have repeated the feat. There are two kinds of end-to-end hikers, those who do it in a single season, known as through hikers, and those who do it in chunks, known as section hikers. The record for the longest section hike is 46 years. The Appalachian Trail Conference doesn't recognize speed records on the grounds that that isn't in the spirit of the enterprise, but that doesn't stop people from trying. In the 1980s, a man named Ward Leonard, carrying a full pack and with no support crew, hiked the trail in 60 days, 16 hours. An incredible feat when you consider that it would take you about 5 days to drive an equivalent distance. In May 1991, an ultra-runner named David Horton and an endurance hiker named Scott Grierson set off within 2 days of each other. Horton had a network of support crews waiting at road crossings and other strategic points, and so needed to carry nothing but a bottle of water. Each evening, he was taken by car to a motel or private home. He averaged 38.3 miles a day, with 10 or 11 hours of running. Grierson, meanwhile, merely walked, but he did so for as much as 18 hours a day. Horton finally overtook Grierson in New Hampshire on the 39th day and reached his goal in 52 days, 9 hours. Grierson came in a couple of days later. All kinds of people have completed thru-hikes. One man hiked it in his 80s. Another did it on crutches. A blind man named Bill Irwin hiked the trail with a seeing eye dog and fell down an estimated 5,000 times in the process. Probably the most famous, certainly the most written about of all thru-hikers was Emma Grandma Gatewood, who successfully hiked the trail twice in her late 60s, despite being eccentric, poorly equipped, a tad stupid, actually very stupid, but I don't want to seem unkind, and a danger to herself. She was forever getting lost. My own favorite, however, is a guy named Woodrow Murphy from Pepperell, Massachusetts, who did a thru-hike in the summer of 1995. I would have liked him anyway, just for being called Woodrow, but I especially admired him when I read that he weighed 350 pounds and was doing the hike to lose weight. In his first week on the trail, he managed just 5 miles a day, but he persevered, and by August, when he reached his home state, he was up to a dozen miles a day. He had lost 53 pounds, a trifle, all things considered, and at last report was considering doing it all over again the following year. A significant fraction of thru-hikers reach Katahdin, then turn around and start back to Georgia. They just can't stop walking, which kind of makes you wonder. In fact, the more you read about thru-hikers, the more you end up being filled with a kind of wonder. Take Bill Irwin, the blind man. After his hike, he said, "I never enjoyed the hiking part. It was something I felt compelled to do. It wasn't my choice." Or David Horton, the ultra-runner, who set the speed record in 1991. Horton, by his own account, became a mental and emotional wreck and spent most of the period crossing Maine weeping copiously. Well, then why do it, you stupid tit? Even good old Earl Schaffer ended up as a recluse in the backwoods of Pennsylvania. I don't mean to suggest that hiking the AT drives you potty, just that it takes a certain kind of person to do it. And how did I feel about giving up the quest when a granny in Plimsolls, a human beach ball named Woodrow, and over 3,990 others had made it to Katahdin? Well, pretty good, as a matter of fact. I was still going to hike the Appalachian Trail. I just wasn't going to hike all of it. Katz and I had already walked 500,000 steps, if you can believe it. It didn't seem altogether essential to do the other 4.5 million to get the idea of the thing. So we rode to Knoxville with our comical cab driver, acquired a hire car at the airport, and found ourselves shortly after midday heading north out of Knoxville through a half-remembered world of busy roads, dangling traffic signals, vast intersections, huge signs, an acre upon acre of shopping malls, gas stations, discount stores, exhaust centers, car lots, and all the rest. Even after a day in Gatlinburg, the transition was dazzling. I remember reading once how some Stone Age Indians from the Brazilian rainforest, with no knowledge or expectation of a world beyond the jungle, were taken to Sao Paulo or Rio, and when they saw the buildings and cars and passing airplanes, they wet themselves. Lavishly and in unison. I had some idea how they felt. It is such a strange contrast. When you're on the AT, the forest is your universe, infinite and entire. It is all you experience day after day. Eventually, it is about all you can imagine. You are aware, of course, that somewhere over the horizon there are mighty cities, busy factories, crowded freeways. But here in this part of the country, where woods drape the landscape for as far as the eye can see, the forest rules. Even the little towns like Franklin and Hiawassee, and even Gatlinburg, are just way stations, scattered helpfully through the great cosmos of woods. But come off the trail, properly off, and drive somewhere, as we did now, and you realize how magnificently deluded you have been. Here, the mountains and woods were just backdrop. Familiar, known, nearby, but no more consequential or noticed than the clouds that scudded across their ridgelines. Here, the real business was up close and on top of you,
gas stations, Walmarts, Kmarts, Dunkin' Donuts, Blockbuster videos, a ceaseless, unfolding pageant of commercial hideousness. Even Katz was unnerved by it. "Geez, it's ugly," he breathed in wonder, as if he had never witnessed such a thing before. I looked past him along the line of his shoulder to a vast shopping mall with a prairie-sized car park, and agreed. It was horrible. And then, lavishly and in unison, we wet ourselves. Chapter 10. There is a painting by Asher Brown Durand called Kindred Spirits, which is often reproduced in books when the subject turns to the American landscape in the 19th century. Painted in 1849, it shows two men standing on a rock ledge in the Catskills in one of those sublime lost world settings that look as if they would take an expedition to reach, though the two figures in the painting are dressed incongruously as if for the office, in long coats and plump cravats. Below them, in a shadowy chasm, a stream dashes through a jumble of boulders. Beyond, glimpsed through a canopy of leaves, is a long view of gorgeously forbidding blue mountains. To right and left, jostling into frame, are disorderly ranks of trees, which immediately vanish into consuming darkness. I can't tell you how much I would like to step into that view. The scene is so manifestly untamed, so full of an impenetrable beyond, as to present a clearly foolhardy temptation. You would die out there, for sure. Shredded by a cougar, or thudded with a tomahawk, or just lost and wandering into a stumbling, confounded death. You can see that at a glance. But never mind. Already you were studying the foreground for a way down to the stream over the steep rocks, and wondering if that notch ahead will get you through to the neighboring valley. Farewell, my friends. Destiny calls. Don't wait supper. Nothing like that view exists now, of course. Perhaps it never did. Who knows how much license these romantic Johnnies took with their stabbing brushes? Who, after all, is going to struggle with an easel and camp stool and box of paints to some difficult overlook on a hot July afternoon in a wilderness filled with danger and not paint something exquisite and grand? But even if the pre-industrialized Appalachians were only half as wild and dramatic as in the paintings of Durand and others like him, they must have been something to behold. It is hard to imagine now how little known, how full of possibility the world beyond the eastern seaboard once was. When Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark into the wilderness, he confidently expected them to find woolly mammoths and mastodons. Had dinosaurs been known, he would almost certainly have asked them to bring him home a triceratops. The first people to venture deep into the woods from the east, the Indians, of course, had got there perhaps as much as 20,000 years before them, weren't looking for prehistoric creatures or passages to the west or new lands to settle. They were looking for plants. America's botanical possibilities excited Europeans inordinately, and there was both glory and money to be made out in the woods. The eastern woods teemed with flora unknown to the old world, and there was a huge eagerness from scientists and amateur enthusiasts alike to get a piece of it. Imagine if tomorrow a spaceship found a jungle growing beneath the gassy clouds of Venus. Think what Bill Gates, say, would pay for some tendrilled, purpley lobed piece of Venusian exotica to put in a pot in his greenhouse. That was the rhododendron in the 18th century. And the camellia, the hydrangea, the wild cherry, the rudbeckia, the azalea, the aster, the ostrich fern, the catalpa, the spice bush, the Venus flytrap, the Virginia creeper, the euphorbia. These and hundreds more were collected in the American woods, shipped across the ocean to England and France and Russia, and received with greedy keenness and trembling fingers. It started with John Bartram. Actually, it started with tobacco, but in a scientific sense, it started with John Bartram, a Pennsylvania Quaker born in 1699 who grew interested in botany after reading a book on the subject and began sending seeds and cuttings to a fellow Quaker in London. Encouraged to seek out more, he embarked on increasingly ambitious journeys into the wilderness, sometimes traveling over 1,000 miles through the rugged mountains.
though he was entirely self-taught, never learned Latin, and had scant understanding of Linnaean classifications, he was a prize plant collector, with an uncanny knack for finding and recognizing unknown species. Of the 800 plants discovered in America in the colonial period, Bartram was responsible for about a quarter. His son William found many more. Before the century was out, the eastern woods were fairly crawling with botanists. Peter Kalm, Lars Ljungström, Constantine Samuel Rafinesque Schmaltz, John Fraser, André Michaud, Thomas Nuttall, John Lyon, and others pretty much beyond counting. There were so many people out there hunting so competitively that it is often not possible to say with any precision who discovered what. Depending on which source you consult, Fraser found either 44 new plants or 215, or something in between. One of his uncontested discoveries was the fragrant southern balsam, the Fraser fir, so characteristic of the high ranges of North Carolina and Tennessee. But it bears his name only because he scrambled to the top of Clingman's Dome just ahead of his keen rival Michaud. These people covered astonishing sweeps for considerable periods. One of the younger Bartram's expeditions lasted over 5 years and plunged him so deeply into the woods that he was long given up for lost. When he emerged, he discovered that America had been at war with Britain for a year, and he had lost his patrons. Michaud's voyages took him from Florida to Hudson's Bay. The heroic Nuttall ventured as far as the shores of Lake Superior, going much of the way on foot for want of funds. They often collected in prodigious, not to say rapacious, quantities. Lyon pulled 3,600 Magnolia macrophylla saplings from a single hillside, and thousands of plants more, including a pretty red thing which left him in a fever delirium and covered almost in one continued blister all over my body. He had found, it turned out, poison sumac. In 1765, John Bartram discovered a particularly lovely camellia, Franklinia altamaha. Already rare, it was hunted to extinction in just 25 years. Today, it survives only in cultivation, thanks entirely to Bartram. Rafinesque Schmaltz, meanwhile, spent 7 years wandering through the Appalachians, didn't discover much, but brought in 50,000 seeds and cuttings. How they managed it is a wonder. Every plant had to be recorded and identified, its seeds collected or a cutting taken. If the latter, it had to be potted up in stiff paper or sailcloth, kept watered and tended, and somehow transported through a trackless wilderness to civilization. The privations and perils were constant and exhausting. Bears, snakes, and panthers abounded. Michaud's son was severely mauled on one expedition when a bear charged him from the trees. Black bears seem to have been notably more ferocious in former times. Nearly every journal has accounts of sudden, unprovoked attacks. It seems altogether likely that eastern bears have become more retiring because they have learned to associate humans with guns. Indians, too, were commonly hostile, though just as often bemused at finding European gentlemen carefully collecting and taking away plants that grew in natural abundance. And then there were all the diseases of the woods, like malaria and yellow fever. I can't find one friend that will bear the fatigue to accompany me in my peregrinations, John Bartram complained wearily in a letter to his English patron. Hardly surprising. But evidently, it was worth it. A single particularly valued seed could fetch up to 5 guineas. On one trip, John Lyon cleared £900 after expenses, a considerable fortune, then returned the next year and made nearly as much. Fraser made one long trip under the sponsorship of Catherine the Great of Russia and emerged from the wilderness only to find that there was a new czar who had no interest in plants, thought he was mad, and refused to honor his contract. So Fraser took everything to Chelsea, where he had a little nursery, and made a good living selling azaleas, rhododendrons, and magnolias to the English gentry. Others did it for the simple joy of finding something new. None more admirably than Thomas Nuttall, a bright but unschooled journeyman printer from Liverpool, who came to America in 1808 and discovered an unexpected passion for plants. He undertook two long expeditions, which he paid for out of his own pocket, made many important discoveries, and generously gave to the Liverpool Botanic Gardens plants that might have made him rich. In just 9 years, from a base of zero, he became the leading authority on American plants. In 1817, he produced, literally, for he not only wrote the text but set most of the type himself, the seminal Genera of North American Plants, which stood for the better part of a century as the principal encyclopedia of American botany. 4 years later, he was named curator of the Botanic Garden at Harvard University, a position he held with distinction for a dozen years, and somehow also found time to become a leading authority on birds, producing a celebrated text on American ornithology in 1832. He was, by all accounts, a kindly man who gained the esteem of everyone who met him. Stories don't get a great deal better than that. Already in Nuttall's day, the woods were being transformed. The panthers, elk, and timber wolves were being driven to extinction, the beaver and bear nearly so. The great first-growth white pines of the North Woods, some of them 220 feet high, that's the height of a 20-story building, had mostly been felled to make ship's masts or simply cleared away for farmland, and nearly all the rest would go before the century was out. Everywhere there was a kind of recklessness, born of a sense that the American woods were effectively inexhaustible. 200-year-old pecan trees were commonly chopped down just to make it easier to harvest the nuts on their topmost branches. With each passing year, the character of the woods changed perceptibly. But until quite recent times, painfully recent times, one thing remained in abundance that preserved the primeval, super-Eden feel of the original forest, the massively graceful American chestnut. There has never been a tree like it. Rising 100 feet from the forest floor, its soaring boughs spread out in a canopy of incomparable lushness, an acre of leaves per tree, a million or so in all. Though only half the height of the tallest eastern pines, the chestnut had a weight and mass and symmetry that put it in another league. At ground level, a full-sized tree would be 10 feet through its bole, more than 20 feet around. I have seen a photograph, taken at the start of this century, of people picnicking in a grove of chestnuts not far from where Katz and I now hiked, in an area known as the Jefferson National Forest. It is a happy Sunday party in heavy clothes, the ladies with clasped parasols, the men with bowler hats and walrus mustaches, all handsomely arrayed on a blanket in a clearing against a backdrop of steeply slanting shafts of light and trees of unbelievable grandeur. The people are so tiny, so preposterously out of scale to the trees around them, as to make you wonder for a moment if the picture has been manipulated as a kind of joke, like those old postcards that show watermelons as big as barns, or an ear of corn that entirely fills a wagon under the droll legend, "A typical Iowa farm scene." But this is simply the way it was. The way it was over tens of thousands of square miles of hill and cove from the Carolinas to New England. And it is all gone now. In 1904, a keeper at the Bronx Zoo in New York noticed that the zoo's handsome chestnuts had become covered in small orange cankers of an unfamiliar type. Within days, they began to sicken and die. By the time scientists identified the source as an Asian fungus called Endothia parasitica, probably introduced with a shipment of trees or infected lumber from the Orient, the chestnuts were dead, and the fungus had escaped into the great sprawl of the Appalachians, where one tree in every four was a chestnut. For all its mass, a tree is a remarkably delicate thing. All of its internal life exists within three paper-thin layers of tissue, the phloem, xylem, and cambium, just beneath the bark, which together form a moist sleeve around the dead heartwood. However tall it grows, a tree is just a few pounds of living cells thinly spread between roots and leaves. These three diligent layers of cells perform all the intricate science and engineering needed to keep the tree alive, and the efficiency with which they do it is one of the wonders of life. Without noise or fuss, every tree in a forest lifts massive volumes of water, several hundred gallons in the case of a large tree on a hot day, from its roots to its leaves, where it is returned to the atmosphere. Imagine the din and commotion, the clutter of machinery that would be needed for a fire department to raise a similar volume of water to that of a single tree. And lifting water is just one of the many jobs that the phloem, xylem, and cambium perform. They also manufacture lignin and cellulose, regulate the storage and production of tannin, sap, gum, oils, and resins, dole out minerals and nutrients, convert starches into sugars for future growth, which is where maple syrup comes into the picture, and goodness knows what else. But because all this is happening in such a thin layer, it also leaves the tree terribly vulnerable to invasive organisms. To combat this, trees have formed elaborate defense mechanisms. The reason a rubber tree seeps latex when cut is that this is its way of saying to insects and other organisms, "Not tasty. Nothing here for you. Go away." Trees can also deter destructive creatures like caterpillars by flooding their leaves with tannin, which makes the leaves less tasty and so inclines the caterpillars to look elsewhere. When infestations are particularly severe, some trees can even communicate the fact. Some species of oak release a chemical that tells other oaks in the vicinity that an attack is underway. In response, the neighboring oaks step up their tannin production, the better to withstand the coming onslaught. By such means, of course, does nature tick along. The problem arises when a tree encounters an attacker for which evolution has left it unprepared. And seldom has a tree been more helpless against an invader than the American chestnut against Endothia parasitica. It enters the chestnut effortlessly, devours the cambium cells, and positions itself for attack on the next tree before the tree has the faintest idea, chemically speaking, what hit it. It spreads by means of spores, which are produced in the hundreds of millions in each canker. A single woodpecker can transfer a billion spores on one flight between trees. At the height of the American chestnut blight, every woodland breeze would loose spores in unaccountable trillions to drift in a pretty lethal haze onto neighboring hillsides. The mortality rate was 100%. In just over 35 years, the American chestnut became a memory. The Appalachians alone lost 4 billion trees, a quarter of its cover, in a generation. A great tragedy, of course. But how lucky, when you think about it, that these diseases are at least species-specific. Instead of a chestnut blight or Dutch elm disease or dogwood anthracnose, what if there was just a tree blight? Something indiscriminate and unstoppable that swept through whole forests. In fact, there is. It's called acid rain. But let's stop there. I think we've both had enough science for one chapter. But hold that thought, please, and bear it in mind when I tell you that there wasn't a day in the Appalachian woods when I didn't give passing thanks for what there was. So the forest through which Katz and I passed now was nothing like the forest that was known even to people of my father's generation. But at least it was a forest. It was splendid, in any case, to be enveloped once more in our familiar surroundings. It was in every detectable respect the same forest that we had left in North Carolina. Same violently slanted trees, same narrow brown path, same expansive silence, broken only by our tiny grunts and labored breaths as we struggled up hills that proved to be as steep, if not quite as lofty, as those we had left behind. But curiously, though we had come a couple of hundred miles north, spring seemed further advanced here. The trees, predominantly oak, were more fully in bud, and there were occasional clumps of wildflowers, bloodroot and trillium and Dutchman's breeches, rising through the carpet of last year's leaves. Sunlight filtered through the branches overhead, throwing spotlights on the path, and there was a certain distinctive, heady spring lightness in the air. We took off first our jackets, and then our sweaters. The world seemed altogether a genial place. Best of all, there were views, luscious and golden to left and right. For 400 miles through Virginia, the Blue Ridge is essentially a single long fin, only a mile or two wide, notched here and there with deep V-shaped passes called gaps, but otherwise holding generally steady at about 3,000 feet, with a broad green valley of Virginia stretching off to the Allegheny Mountains to the west and lazy pastoral Piedmont to the east. So here, each time we hauled ourselves to a mountaintop and stepped onto a rocky overlook, instead of seeing nothing but endless tufted green mountains stretching to the horizon, we got airy views of a real, lived-in world. Sunny farms, clustered hamlets, clumps of woodland and winding highways, all made exquisitely picturesque by distance. Even an interstate highway, with its cloverleaf interchanges and parallel carriageways, looked benign and thoughtful, like the illustrations you used to get in children's books in my boyhood, showing an America that was busy and on the move, but not too busy to be attractive. We walked for a week and hardly saw a soul. One afternoon, I met a man who had been section hiking for 25 years with a bicycle and a car. Each morning, he would drop the bike at a finishing point 10 miles or so down the trail, drive the car back to the start, hike between the two, and cycle back to his car. He did this for 2 weeks every April, and figured he had about another 20 years to go. Another day, I followed an older man, lean and rangy, who looked to be well into his 70s. He had a small, old-fashioned day pack of tawny canvas and moved with extraordinary swiftness. Two or three times an hour, I would sight him just ahead, 50 or 60 yards away, vanishing into the trees. Though he moved much faster than I did and never seemed to rest, he was always there. Wherever there was 50 or 60 yards of view, there he would be, just the back of him, just disappearing. It was like following a ghost. I tried to catch him up and couldn't. He never looked at me that I could see, but I was sure he was aware of me behind him. You get a kind of sixth sense for the presence of others in the woods, and when you realize people are near, you always pause to let them catch up, just to exchange pleasantries and say hello, and maybe find out if anyone has heard a weather forecast. But the man ahead never paused, never varied his pace, never looked back. In the late afternoon, he vanished, and I never saw him again. In the evening, I told Katz about it. "Jesus," he muttered privately, "now he's hallucinating on me." But the next day, Katz saw him all day, but behind him, following, always near but never overtaking. It was very weird. After that, neither of us saw him again. We didn't see anyone. In consequence, we had shelters to ourselves each night, which was a big treat. You know your life has grown pathetic when you're thrilled to have a covered wooden platform to call your own, but there you are, we were thrilled. The shelters along this section of trail were mostly new and spanking clean. Several were even provisioned with a broom, a cozy domestic touch. Moreover, the brooms were used. We used them and whistled while we did it, proving that if you give an AT hiker an appliance of comfort, he will use it responsibly. Each shelter had a nearby privy, a good water source, and a picnic table, so we could prepare and eat our meals in a more or less normal posture, instead of squatting on damp logs. All of these are great luxuries on the trail. On the fourth night, just as I was facing the dismal prospect of finishing my only book, and thereafter having nothing to do in the evenings but lie in the half-light and listen to Cat's snore, I was delighted, thrilled, sublimely gratified to find that some earlier user had left a Graham Greene paperback. If there is one thing the AT teaches, it is low-level ecstasy, something we could all do with more of in our lives. So I was happy. We were doing 15 or 16 miles a day, nothing like the 25 miles we'd been promised we would do, but still a perfectly respectable distance by our lights. I felt springy and fit, and for the first time in years had a stomach that didn't look like a ball bag. I was still weary and stiff at the end of the day, that never stopped, but I had reached the point where aches and blisters were so central a feature of my existence that I ceased to notice them. Each time you leave the cosseted and hygienic world of towns and take yourself into the hills, you go through a series of staged transformations, a kind of gentle descent into squalor. And each time it is as if you have never done it before. At the end of the first day, you feel mildly, self-consciously grubby. By the second day, disgustingly so. By the third, you are beyond caring. By the fourth, you have forgotten what it is like not to be like this. Hunger, too, follows a defined pattern. On the first night, you are starving for your noodles. On the second night, you are starving, but wish it wasn't noodles. On the third, you don't want the noodles, but know you had better eat something. By the fourth, you have no appetite at all, but just eat because that is what you do at this time of day. I can't explain it, but it's strangely agreeable. And then something happens to make you realize how much, how immeasurably much, you want to revisit the real world. On our sixth night, after a long day in uncharacteristically dense woods, we emerged towards evening at a small grassy clearing on a high bluff with a long, sensational, unobstructed view to the north and west. The sun was just falling behind the distant blue-gray Allegheny Ridge, and the country between, a plain of broad, orderly farms, each with a clump of trees and a farmhouse, was just at that point where it was beginning to drain of color. But the feature that made us gawp was a town, a real town. The first we had seen in a week, that stood perhaps 6 or 7 miles to the north. From where we stood, we could just make out what were clearly the large, brightly lit, colored signs of roadside restaurants and big motels. I don't think I have ever seen anything that looked half so beautiful, a quarter so tantalizing. I would almost swear to you I could smell the steaks grilling. We stared at it for ages, as if it were something we had read about in books, but had never expected to see. Waynesboro, I said to Katz at last. He nodded solemnly. How far? I pulled up my map and had a look. About 8 miles by trail. He nodded solemnly again. Good, he said. It was, I realized, the longest conversation we had had in 2 or 3 days, but there was no need to say anything more. We had been a week on the trail, and were going to town the next day. That was self-evident. We would hike 8 miles, get a room, have a shower, phone home, do laundry, eat dinner, buy groceries, watch TV, sleep in a bed, eat breakfast, return to the trail. All this was known and obvious. Everything we did was known and obvious. It was wonderful, really. So we pitched our tents and fixed noodles with the last of our water, then sat side by side on a log, eating in silence, facing Waynesboro. A full moon rose in the pale evening sky, and glowed with a rich white inner light that brought to mind but perfectly the creamy inside of an Oreo cookie. Eventually on the trail everything reminds you of food. After a long period of silence I turned to Katz and asked him abruptly, in a tone that was hopeful rather than accusatory, "Do you know how to make anything besides noodles?" I had been thinking, I guess, about resupplying the next day. He thought about this for a good while. "French toast," he said at last, and grew silent for a long period before inclining his head towards me very slightly and saying, "You?" No, I said at length. "Nothing." Katz considered the implications of this, looked for a moment as if he might say something, then shook his head stoically and returned to his dinner. Chapter 11. Now here's a thought to consider. Every 20 minutes on the Appalachian Trail, Katz and I walked further than the average American walks in a week. For 93% of all trips outside the home, for whatever distance or whatever purpose, Americans now get in a car. That's ridiculous. When we moved to the States, one of the things we wanted was to live in a town where we could walk to the shops and post office and library. We found such a place in Hanover, New Hampshire. It's a small, pleasant college town with a big green, leafy residential streets, an old-fashioned main street. Nearly everyone in town is within an easy, level walk of the center, and yet almost no one walks anywhere, ever, for anything. I have a neighbor who drives 800 yards to work. I know another, a perfectly fit woman, who will drive 100 yards to pick up her child from a friend's house. When school lets out here, virtually every child, except for four bitching kids with English accents, gets picked up and driven from a few hundred yards to three-quarters of a mile home. Those who live further away get a bus. Most of the children 16 or older have their own cars. That's ridiculous, too. On average, the total walking of an American these days, that's walking of all types, from car to office, from office to car, round the supermarket and shopping malls, adds up to 1.4 miles a week. Barely 350 yards a day. At least in Hanover, we can walk. In many places in America now, it is not actually possible to be a pedestrian, even if you want to be. I had this brought home to me the next day in Waynesboro, after we had got a room and treated ourselves to an extravagant late breakfast. I left Katz at a laundrette. He loved doing laundry for some reason. Loved to read the tattered magazines and experience the miracle of stiff, disgusting clothes emerging from big machines fluffed and sweet-smelling, and set off to find some insect repellent for us. Waynesboro had a traditional, vaguely pleasant central business district covering 5 or 6 square blocks, but as so often these days, most retail businesses had moved out to shopping centers on the periphery, leaving little but a sprinkling of banks, insurance offices, and dusty thrift stores or second-hand shops in what presumably was once a thriving downtown. Lots of shops were dark and bare, and there was nowhere I could find to get insect repellent. But a man outside the post office suggested I try Kmart. "Where's your car?" he said, preparatory to giving directions. "I don't have a car." That stopped him. "Really? It's over a mile, I'm afraid." "That's okay." He gave his head a little dubious shake, as if disowning responsibility for what he was about to tell me. "Well, then, what you want to do is go up Broad Street, take a right at the Burger King, and keep on going. But you know, when I think about it, it's well over a mile, maybe a mile and a half, mile and three quarters. You walking back as well?" "Yeah." Another shake. "Long way. I'll take emergency provisions." If he realized this was a joke, he didn't show it. "Well, good luck to you," he said. "Thank you." "You know, there's a cab company around the corner," he offered, helpfully, as an afterthought. "I actually prefer to walk," I explained. He nodded uncertainly. "Well, good luck to you," he said again. So I walked. It was a warm afternoon, and it felt wonderful. You can't believe how wonderful. To be at large without a pack, bouncy and unburdened. With a pack, you walk at a tilt, hunched and pressed forward, your eyes on the ground. You trudge. It is all you can do. Without, you are liberated. You walk erect. You look around. You spring. You saunter. You amble. Or at least you do for 4 blocks. Then you come to a mad junction at Burger King and discover that the new 6-lane road to Kmart is long, straight, very busy, and entirely without facilities for pedestrians. No sidewalks, no zebra crossings, no central refuges, no buttons to push for a walk signal at lively intersections. I walked through gas station and motel forecourts, across restaurant car parks, clambered over concrete barriers, crossed lawns, and pushed through neglected ranks of privet or honeysuckle at property boundaries. At bridges over creeks and culverts, and goodness me how developers love a culvert, I had no choice but to walk on the road, pressed against the dusty railings and causing less attentive cars to swerve to avoid me. 4 times I was honked at for having the temerity to proceed through town without benefit of metal. One bridge was so patently dangerous that I hesitated at it. The creek it crossed was only a reedy trickle, narrow enough to step across. So I decided to go that way. I slid and scampered down the bank, found myself in a hidden zone of sucking gray mud, pitched over 2 times, hauled myself up on the other side, pitched over again, and emerged at length streaked and speckled with mud and extravagantly decorated with burrs. When I finally reached the Kmart Plaza, I discovered that I was on the wrong side of the road and had to dash through 6 lanes of hostile traffic. By the time I crossed the car park and stepped into the air-conditioned, Muzak-happy world of Kmart,
I was as grubby as if I had been on the trail, and trembling all over.
The Kmart, it turned out, didn't stock insect repellent. So I turned round and set off back to town, but this time, in a burst of madness I don't even want to go into, I headed home cross-country, over farm fields and a zone of light industry. I tore my jeans on barbed wire and got muddier still. When finally I got back to town, I found Kat sitting in the sun on a metal chair on the motel lawn, freshly showered, dressed in newly laundered attire, and looking intensely happy in a way that only a hiker can look when he is in a town at ease. Technically, he was waxing his boots, but really he was just sitting, watching the world go by, and dreamily enjoying the sunshine. He greeted me warmly. Katz was always a new man in town.
"Good Lord, look at you," he cried, delighted at my grubbiness. "What have you been doing? You're filthy."
He looked me up and down admiringly, then said in a more solemn tone, "You haven't been screwing hogs again, have you, Bryson?"
"Ha, ha, ha. They're not clean animals, you know, no matter how attractive they may look after a month on the trail. And don't forget, we're not in Tennessee anymore. It's probably not even legal here, at least without a note from the vet."
He patted the chair beside him, beaming all over, happy with his quips.
"Come and sit down and tell me all about it. So what was her name, Bossy?"
He leaned closely and confidentially. "Did she squeal a lot?" I sat in the chair. "You're only jealous."
"Well, as a matter of fact, I'm not. I made a friend of my own today, at the laundromat.
Her name's Beulah."
"Beulah? You're joking."
"I may wish I was, but it's a fact."
"Nobody's named Beulah."
"Well, she is.
And real nice, too. Not real smart, but real nice. With cute little dimples just here."
He poked his cheeks to show me where. "And she has a terrific body."
"Oh, yes?"
He nodded. "Of course," he added judiciously, "it's buried under 220 pounds of wobbling fat. Fortunately, I don't mind size in a woman as long as, you know, you don't have to remove a wall or anything to get her out of the house." He gave his boot a thoughtful swipe.
"So, how did you meet her?"
"As a matter of fact," he said, sitting forward keenly as if this was a story worth telling, "she asked me to come and look at her panties." I nodded. "Of course."
"They'd got caught in the washing machine agitator," he explained.
"And was she wearing them at the time? You said she wasn't real smart."
"No, she was washing them, and the elastic got stuck in the spindle thing, and she asked me to come and help extract them. Big panties," he added thoughtfully, and fell into a brief reverie at the memory of it. Then continued, "I got them out, but they were shredded all to hell, so I said kind of droll-like, 'Well, miss, I sure hope you got another pair, because these are shredded all to hell.'"
"Oh, Stephen, the wit."
"It'll do for Waynesboro, believe me. And she said, now here's the thing, my grubby hog-humping friend, she said, 'Well, wouldn't you like to know, honey?'"
He made his eyebrows bounce. "I'm meeting her at 7, outside the fire station."
"What, she keeps her spare knickers there?"
He gave me an exasperated look.
"No, it's just a place to meet. We're going to Papa John's Pizza for dinner, and then, with any luck, we'll do what you've been doing all day. Only I won't have to climb a fence and lure her with alfalfa."
"Well, I hope not, anyway."
"Hey, look at this," he said, and reached down to a paper bag at his feet. He brought out a pair of pink female knickers that could fairly be called capacious. "I thought I'd give them to her as a kind of joke, you understand?"
"In a restaurant?"
"Are you sure that's a good idea?"
"Discreetly, you know." I held up the knickers with outstretched arms. They really were quite arrestingly jumbo-sized.
"If she doesn't like them, you can always use them as a ground sheet.
Are these, I have to ask, are these this big as part of the joke, or,
"Oh, she's a big woman," Kat said, and bounced his eyebrows again happily.
He put them neatly, reverently back in the bag.
"Big woman." So I dined alone at a place called the Coffee Mill Restaurant. It felt a little odd to be without cats after so many days of constant companionship, but agreeable as well, for the same reason. I was eating a steak dinner, my book propped against a sugar shaker, entirely content,
When I glanced up to find Katz stalking towards me across the restaurant, looking alarmed and furtive.
"Thank God I found you," he said, and took a seat opposite me in the booth. He was sweating freely. "There's some guy looking for me."
"What are you talking about?"
"Beulah's husband."
"Beulah has a husband?"
"I know. It's a miracle. There can't be more than two people on the planet who'd be willing to sleep with her, and here we are both in the same town."
This was all going too fast for me. "I don't understand. What happened?"
"I was standing outside the fire station, you know, like we'd agreed, and a red pickup truck screeches to a stop, and this guy gets out looking real angry and saying he's Beulah's old man and he wants to talk to me."
"So what did you do?"
"I ran. What do you think?"
"And he didn't catch you?"
"He weighed about 600 pounds. He wasn't exactly the sprinting type, and more the shoot-your-balls-off type. He's been cruising around for a half hour looking for me. I've been running through backyards and crashing into clotheslines and all kinds of shit. I ended up with some other guy chasing me because he thought I was a prowler. What the hell am I supposed to do now, Bryson?"
"Okay. First, you stop talking to fat ladies in laundromats."
Yeah.
"Then I go out of here, see if the coast is clear, and give you a signal from the window."
"Yeah? And then?"
"Then you walk very briskly back to the motel with your hands over your balls and hope this guy doesn't spot you." He was quiet a moment.
"That's it? That's your best plan? That's your very best plan?"
"Have you got a better one?"
"No, but I didn't go to college for 4 years."
"Stephen, I didn't study how to save your ass in Waynesboro. I majored in political science. If your problem was to do with proportional representation in Switzerland, I might be able to help you." He sighed and sat back heavily with his arms crossed, bleakly considering his position and how he'd got himself into this fix.
"You don't let me talk to any women again of any size, at least until we get out of the Confederacy. These guys have all got guns down here. You promise?"
"Oh, it's a promise." He sat in edgy silence while I finished my dinner, swiveling his head to check out all the windows, expecting to see a fat, angry face pressed against the glass. When I had finished and paid the bill, we went to the door.
"I could be dead in a minute," he said grimly, then clutched my forearm. "Look, if I get shot, do me a favor. Call my brother and tell him there's $10,000 buried in a coffee can under his front lawn."
"You buried $10,000 under your brother's front lawn?"
"No, of course not. But he's a little prick and it would serve him right. Let's go."
I stepped outside and the street was clear, completely empty of traffic. Waynesboro was at home, in front of the TV. I gave him a nod. His head came out, looked cautiously left and right, and he tore off down the street at a rate that was, all things considered, astounding. It took me 2 or 3 minutes to stroll to the motel. I didn't see anyone. At the motel, I knocked on his door. Instantly, a preposterously deep, authoritative voice said,
"Who is it?"
I sighed. "Bubba T. Flubba, I want to talk to you, boy."
"Bryson, don't fuck around. I can see you through the peephole."
"Then why are you asking who it is?"
"Practicing."
I waited a minute. "Are you going to let me in?"
"Can't. I've got a chest of drawers in front of the door."
"Are you serious? Go to your room and I'll call you."
My room was next door, but the phone was already ringing when I got there.
Katz wanted every detail of my walk home and had elaborate plans for his defense, involving a heavy ceramic lamp base and, ultimately, escape out of the back window. My role was to create a diversion, ideally by setting the man's truck alight, then running in a contrary direction. Twice more in the night, once just after midnight, he called me to tell me that he had seen a red pickup truck cruising the streets. In the morning, he refused to go out for breakfast, so I went to the supermarket for groceries and brought us both a bag of food from Hardee's. He wouldn't leave the room until the cab was waiting by the motel office with a motor running. It was 4 miles back to the trail. He looked out of the back window the whole way. End of side 4.